TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. The Colonial Urge to Make Money Out of the Climate Crisis, Part 2 of 2. False Solutions on the Agenda of the Upcoming Climate Change Conference, COP28. This radio program reports from a webinar held on October 26 by the Indigenous Climate Action. Panelists from Hoopa Valley, Bear Clan, Sandia Pueblo, and Yuchi presented their in-depth research into false solutions to the climate crisis. By now, there's agreement that the burning of fossil fuels is the major cause of global heating. However, after 28 years of annual meetings, the UN climate change conferences have not made a difference. Meanwhile, the global average temperature for July 2023 was the highest on record, according to international weather agencies. And the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, announced in August 2023 that fossil fuel subsidies surged to a record of $7 trillion. In response, members of the European Parliament now call for an end to all subsidies for fossil fuel globally by 2025. They will bring this demand to the COP28 that will meet from November 30 to December 12, 2023. The problem might be that COP28 will be held in one of the world's most lucrative oil-producing regions, and Dr. Sultan Al-Jaber, who has been appointed to preside over the COP28, is the managing director and group CEO of the Abu Dhabi National Oil Company, ADNOC. He is the moderator of the meeting on false solutions at Indigenous Climate Action, Carol Montour.
Our next question is on false solutions in the UNFCCC, the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, the Conference of the Parties, which we'll be meeting next month in Dubai. Thomas Joseph, I know that your team at the Indigenous Environmental Network has put a lot of work in the years to bringing awareness through the UNFCCC. So what are, in your opinion, some of the false solutions being pushed forward by the United Nations?
Again, some of the major concerns that I have that's being pushed by the UNFCCC pertains to the market mechanisms, pertaining to how we continue to allow communities of color to be sacrifice zones, and how we are, the main focus is to allow business as usual. When we look at the last previous COPs in Scotland and then in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, we have seen a continual increase of representation from the fossil fuel industry. Even this year, with the COP being in Dubai, how the president of COP is a fossil fuel logo, like he's a giant. He's been in the fossil fuel industry the majority of his life, and he is leading COP28, you know? And so how are we supposed to be able to address the real solutions of climate change when the conversation is held hostage by the fossil fuel industry? And these market mechanisms are their pathway forward to addressing climate change, you know? And these market mechanisms are not only just forest offsets or biodiversity offsets, but we're now seeing how nature-based solutions are going to be commodified, and how agricultural farmers, and how the price tag on whales and buffalo are going to be moving forward to address climate change, when really we need to be able to keep fossil fuels in the ground. We need to be able to move forward in a direction that allows us to be able to have a just transition. Now, we even seen them using that language for their benefit. And so now the Indigenous Environmental Network has played a very active role in introducing an Indigenous just transition. And I encourage everybody to look up IANEarth.org and find our literature on an Indigenous just transition and how you can implement that in your communities at home. It'll be an exciting day when we're able to limit the influence of the fossil fuel industry into these United Nations spaces. In Germany, this last year, we've seen a step forward in that, where if you are a lobbyist of the fossil fuel industry, you now have to register as a lobbyist, and so that we can identify you. We also know that a lot of the representatives in the parties, for those that don't know, parties are nation representatives in the United Nations space. And so you come in with a party badge. We know a lot of those party delegates are also members of the fossil fuel industry. So we need to push them out of COP. You know, fossil fuel industry shouldn't have any leg or any stance in dictating the direction of climate change in COP spaces. We also need to understand that civil society may have to find a different venue, a different way forward. Perhaps COP, the convening of parties, is not the space to resolve climate change. It is failing. COP has, since the Paris Climate Agreement and even before, has not produced any real results in reducing emissions at source. We have seen a continuation of the fossil fuels burning, and not just in industrialized countries, but in non-industrialized countries as well. Coming from the global south, their emissions are also increasing. And when we think about internationally traded mitigation outcomes being attached to the nationally determined contribution of our countries and being allowed to exchange our ability to meet our Paris Climate Accord by using indigenous communities as sacrifice zones for offset projects in the global south, so the global north can continue to burn its emissions, you know, those things need to be addressed. And then we haven't even talked about the importance of recognizing the accountability and responsibility of the countries of the global north to meet the needs of the global south when it comes to climate chaos, when it comes to these countries that are experiencing huge storms and sea rise, and how these nations are being gravely affected by climate change today because of the results of the global north. We owe them. We need to pay restitution for the crimes and for the harm that we have already caused. But you look at the United States, they're trying to neglect those responsibilities. We have a responsibility of burning those fossil fuels and committing to climate chaos. And we need to be held to that account. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Thomas Joseph. So I think I'm going to also ask something that came up again, and something that people have been asking in the Q&A is about net zero. I'll start with Julia. If you could just give like a rundown on what net zero is and sort of, again, like how this is being pushed forward.
Yeah. So I tried to answer one of the questions in the chat kind of simply, like, net zero can only exist like on paper, because net zero is only accomplished through offsetting. And in order to offset, you have to put a price tag on clean air and a price tag on carbon. And so I tried to use like an example of like, okay, say I owned like a farm, you know, maybe it was like an acre big, and the soil on my farm sequesters like X amount of carbon, which is good. That's dynamic process. That's the way the world works, you know. Trees, grasslands, soils, healthy soils, all sequester carbon. Oceans, algae, they sequester carbon naturally. It's when you quantify how much carbon is sequestered and then place a dollar price on it. One, it's very hard to quantify how much carbon is actually sequestered, because there's like several different parameters that you have to like, you know, consider: elevation, climate, you know, the temperature outside even has an impact on how much carbon is sequestered. So those numbers are made up. So then those numbers are then, you know, commodified and create credits. Those credits then can be traded, bought, and sold all over the world. So while my little farm is sequestering, you know, this amount of carbon, Exxon, Shell, BP, whoever could be buying those credits and saying that they are offsetting the carbon that they emit at their, you know, production sites. And that is how on paper they would be able to show that they are, you know, inching towards net zero pledges. that doesn't address direct emissions reductions. It's commodifying nature, it's commodifying clean air, and it's a completely made up system. It's a market opportunity. There's a climate crisis, therefore there's a market opportunity. And that's the way that net zero functions in false solutions, because it's allowing for new markets to open on a global scale, whether they're regulated by the government or not. And that's like why there's such a strong mobilization against net zero, when we could be implementing climate targets that phase out fossil fuels. So you wouldn't even have to count or commodify how much carbon or clean air a certain geography is producing. You would just be decreasing the use of fossil fuels over time. I don't know, Thomas, if you feel like jumping in on the net zero conversation or stage two, that's the, I think, the best example that I got right now.
Yeah, Thomas, is there a way to take back the concept of net zero to bring it back to its original definition?
Thank you. And Julia did an amazing job in that. So thank you, Julia. For me, net zero is the new climate denier. You know, when you are openly admitting to trying to achieve a net zero target, you don't really believe that we are in a climate chaos. You don't really believe that that we created climate change and that the fossil fuel industry needs to reduce emissions. For me, net zero, you're a climate denier, basically. What we need is real zero. When you're cooking the books to prove that you're going to reach net zero by some date of 2030 or 2050 or whatever it may be, when you're cooking those books, you're cooking the planet. So we need real zero, not net zero. Thank you.
Yeah, amazing. I'm seeing another question from Helena in the chat that I'll post to everybody of what an Indigenous alternative to COP would look like. Julia?
There needs to be ability for Indigenous peoples to caucus, to be in space with each other, to talk about our value systems and how Indigenous worldview fits into, you know, the white man's market, into global capitalism. Because, you know, oftentimes too, like the COP is like the Disneyland for false solutions. I mean, you see like pavilions that are, you know, talking about using nuclear energy. Nuclear energy is clean energy. Hydrogen energy for the future. It gives me like the ick a lot. And so all of that's in your face, and that's where the coercion comes in, because then you're cornering Indigenous populations and coercing them to agreeing to enter agreements that commodify nature, which goes against our value systems. And so if there's an alternative to the COP, it has to be a space that doesn't coerce us into making the wrong decisions, or making decisions that could have generational impact. I mean, that's a very meta question. Like, what would be the alternative? And I think a lot of us collectively are starting to think about, you know, what that might possibly look like. But I'm all about community-based solutions. And so if there's a time and place where we can discuss an alternative space together, then I guess we'll have to have another webinar and tell you all what that answer is.
Thank you, Julia. I'll pass this one off to Sage, because Sage is involved with a collective called Muskrat Collective, BIPOC to COP, which brings Black, Indigenous, racialized youth from all over to attend COP. So for you, what would an alternative to COP look like?
We actually thought about this law as a law as a delegation, especially my other delegation from Gahnawaga, Yungwarung Tsinunstats, which means we mind her the earth. And we thought about this on so many levels, because we realize as youth attending these UN spaces, which is already super cold, right? they neglect a lot of aspects. They neglect youth voices, elder voices, Indigenous voices in general, and there needs to be space for that. And when they come up with these so-called solutions, they're not thinking like with our principles. And that's like with the good mind, so like love and strength. And then also the primary one is the seven generational principle. They don't think seven generations ahead. They think of the now and how much money we can make right now. And I think that's really neglected. And if we're thinking about like this idea of making like a I think it's important that we all come with our traditional knowledge and strength from each nation we come from and come on a nation-to-nation relationship and embedded on those terms of of that good mind. Because if we neglect that aspect, then we neglect who we are in our relationship to our mother, the earth. And it's really important and prominent that we keep that, because like the mother, like in our creation story, the earth is the first person to greet us when we come here. And it's the last person to take care of our bodies when we leave here. And it's important that we have that relationship with her. And when we come together and discuss what these solutions should be, that element should really be that core of it, that love that we have for each other, right? And I think if we all came together on different levels of having our youth come together and then having the middle age group come together and then our elders come together and we all learn from each other generationally, then we're looking at all forefronts. And then we can also connect with our animal relatives too, like not neglecting any aspects of it. Cause I feel like a lot of the people neglect other nations, you know? So it's really important that we keep on all like these levels all together and we think about solutions.
Yeah, thank you, Sage. I love how we're all just basically planning our Indigenous co-op now. And so I think I'll pass this off to Thomas Joseph. I do want to mention one thing. If anybody is interested in learning more about false solutions, I recommend checking out Hoodwinked in the Hothouse, which is a resource that the Indigenous Environmental Network and Indigenous Climate Action have been involved with. It's just climatefalsesolutions.org. They have a PDF copy. They have a really great audiobook in multiple different languages. So Thomas Joseph, I would love your perspective on what an alternative would look like.
Thank you. And a people's cop, bring it on. That's what we need. We've been hearing this for a while coming from different delegations and different Indigenous peoples across the globe. We need an alternative to cop. We need a people's cop. And I would love to nominate Sage as its first president, because the information that she just shared and brought forward is the type of information that will be created in a people's cop, where we understand the importance of Indigenous leadership and bringing the ancestral knowledge of our Indigenous peoples to the forefront to have real solutions towards climate change, where we can be able to implement an Indigenous just transition, where there won't be space created to push these false solutions and these narratives to keep colonial powers in power. So, Sage, first president of the People's COP, thank you.
Yeah, thank you, everyone. I love that came out of this. Like, we're talking about false solutions, and then we're already like just living in the future. Somebody said to Julia, "What were the alternative words you used to net zero, real zero, or near zero?" So maybe I'll just pose that to Julia.
Yeah, like real zero, because net is a financial term. You know, like let's think about like your bookkeeping. Like Thomas was sort of saying, like, you have your revenue, but then you have like your discounts on your income or whatever. And that's like your net total. So it's basically like the concept of net zero is basically like a discount on emitting carbon. It's almost like a coupon for emissions. It's only on paper. It's not actually physically decreasing emissions. And so when we're saying real zero or near zero climate targets, that means like no credit systems, no offsetting schemes, just like phasing out fossil fuels, like phasing out the production of fossil fuels, phasing out the transportation and like the market of fossil fuels. And that's how we're going to reach zero. So the term net is where we have an issue. We need to change that language to near zero or real zero, because that's really the only way we're going to reach climate targets to begin with.
Yeah, thank you, Julia. Yeah, I think that's a great point of just like the financial language and just these the same mechanisms that have created the conditions of climate change in the first place are now what's being used to attempt to address it. So just again, thank you to all our panelists. And I think we will just maybe ask anything else that you would like to share about false solutions. And I'll pass to Sage now.
Yeah, so much has happened in this conversation. I'm so happy to be a part of it and be a part of you guys too. It's so exciting. Yeah, just the best advice I can give, I guess, now, just kind of summarizing everything and kind of digesting everything also, is just try to educate as much as possible. Go to ICA's website, go to IAN's website, and go to Pueblo Action Alliance website and go learn. They have like amazing resources, because there's so much to learn and it can be really like difficult to digest, but just, you know, take in what you can, because we're only here for a short amount of time. So we got to make our footprint, right? We got to help plant those seeds for the next generation and be the change we can be in this lifetime. And just remember, like, they couldn't get rid of us the first time. They're not going to get rid of us the second time. We're still here. So let's land back this water back, you know, sky back. And yeah, that's it. That's all for me.
Yeah, thank you, Sage. I'll pass over to Julia about any of your just overall last thoughts on false solutions in this very large topic.
Yeah, I just want to appreciate a comment like of this unlearning. It's so much to unlearn and learn at the same time. And so, you know, a lot of us here have been studying, researching, being in space with each other. I mean, myself, Sage, Thomas, Carol, we're all a part of a cohort where we just like nerd out on false solutions and like, you know, how can we counter narratives that also speak to our community. You know, I encourage folks to, you know, join an organization that is against false solutions, continue going to webinars, community events, reach out. I'm gonna put Thomas on the spot. Reach out to Thomas to be in the next cohort for, you know, the next Train the Trainer program. If you're in New Mexico, reach out to us to, you know, help provide material that can, you know, at least attempt to provide some more accessible information. Yeah, just want to show some love and gratitude for everybody that attended today. And thank you, ICA, for inviting us. Appreciate y'all.
Yeah, thank you, everyone. I'll pass Thomas Joseph.
Thank you. I want to give a big thank you and shout out to ICA for inviting me into this space, as well as the two cohort members, and Carol as well as a cohort member of our first Ring of Fire cohort that IEN hosted earlier in the summer, late spring, around that time. So the Indigenous Environmental Network offers carbon market pricing training, and you can contact me to sign up for a training project. We try to prioritize Indigenous communities because we understand Indigenous communities are the ones that are being targeted for these carbon offset projects. But we also provide these trainings for allied groups and alliances as well. The Pueblo Action Alliance has created a False Solutions Coalition that needs to be copied on a global scale, of alliances being formed to stand against these false solutions that are being introduced into your local communities. But one of the main things that I want to leave everybody with is the importance of the knowledge that you currently hold and the knowledge that you may have learned here today, because with knowledge comes responsibility. When you learn about these issues and you see with your own eyes what's happening to our Mother Earth, how your climate has changed in your region, and knowing that these are the solutions that are being introduced, you are now accountable to that knowledge. You too must strive to push against these false narratives. And the knowledge base, especially if you're an Indigenous person, that you hold, your lineage of your ancestral wisdom, is what needs to come to the forefront, is the real solutions to address climate change. And that too is also being commodified. That too is also being taken advantage of. And so for you, and yourself to know that you come from a legacy of people that understands the importance of a reciprocal relationship with your Mother Earth. and how that is a real solution to climate change, and how that can also identify what a false solution is. And equally important, if you're not Indigenous, the importance of land back, understanding that Indigenous peoples hold tenure over 80% of the world's biodiversity, knowing that they have a greater skill and a greater ability to protect our environment and protect our Mother Earth. And so why not give land back? United States was one of the first countries where we witnessed cultural conservancy areas. That's also being pushed as a false solution. We see the 30 by 30 initiative, which is also a false solution. Understanding that if we created these national parks to protect them, but actually what was the result was the removal of Indigenous peoples, well, then we're in a time period and we are in an emergency time that we should be giving those lands back to the Indigenous peoples, that they can care for those biodiversities and stop the mining and the oil recoveries and all of the encroachment that's being done upon them. There's state parks, there's city parks, there's federal parks. This can all be land back opportunities. So thank you. I'll end with that.
Yeah, thank you. And I feel like the land back part is always just like at the heart of a lot of what comes down to when we talk about this work, of just like that importance. I will also highlight another report from the Indigenous Environmental Network and Oil Change International on Indigenous resistance against carbon. If you haven't checked that out, we highly recommend that. We use that a lot in our curriculum, in our climate leadership program, which compiled about a decade's worth of research to show that in the last 10 years, Indigenous frontline resistance to oil and gas has actually reduced or delayed greenhouse gas emissions about 25% of Canada and the US's potential emissions. So when we talk about these things, we are actually referring to like measurable amounts of greenhouse gases that are reduced.
That was Carol Montour, the Climate Leadership Coordinator at the Indigenous Climate Action, ICA. She's Mohawk Wolf Clan from Six Nations off the Grand River Territory. Before her was Thomas Joseph, Hoopa Valley Tribal Member. He's the Carbon Pricing Educator with the Indigenous Environmental Network, IEN. Sage Goodleaf LaBelle was born to the Bear Clan in what is now Canada. And Julia Bernal is from the Indigenous Nations of Sandia Pueblo and Yuchi, and the Executive Director for Public Action Alliance, Albuquerque, New Mexico. You heard excerpts from an 80-minute conversation that you can see on YouTube under the title Webinar: The Colonial Urge to Commodify the Climate Crisis, Unpacking False Solutions. And my thanks go out to the Indigenous Climate Action, ICA, and the Indigenous Environmental Network, IEN, for this amazing meeting. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, TUCRadio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. Our email address is tuc@tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.